Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 192 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'm just going to be finishing up the adrenal stuff from yesterday. So let's just jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a patient? You know, they tell you over the last like 6 months, this patient has gained a ton of weight. This patient has like new onset hypertension, has like very high blood sugars, has like a, I don't know, like a vertebral compression fracture. And then they tell you that you see purple striae on the skin. If you see that, what are you thinking about? Well, they'll hope you're telling me that you're thinking about Cushing's syndrome, right? Cushing's syndrome, again, by definition, is just anything that arises from hypercortisolism, right? And the thing is, typically, when a person has Cushing's syndrome, you know, they can have like some signs and symptoms, right? Like they'll gain weight, right? They'll have, because remember, cortisol is a diabetogenic hormone, right? They will also have like this weird fat redistribution, right? So their feces will be big, kind of look like the moon, like moon feces, or they can have like the buffalo hump. Remember that some of those AIDS medications, especially the protease inhibitors, can also cause fat redistribution, right? So, you know, they can have like the truncal obesity, high blood pressures, like new onset diabetes. I mean, in general, as a clinician, I try to think twice before I give steroids to diabetics, right? Because you can really, really like do a big number on their diabetes. And again, these people also have a high risk of infection because again, by the different mechanisms I described yesterday, cortisol kind of suppresses the immune system, right? And then they have like the purple striae on the skin and all that stuff, right? So those are the classic things you'll see on an MBM exam with regards to Cushing's syndrome, right? So the thing is, the most common cause of Cushing's syndrome, like I said yesterday, is just a person exogenously taking corticosteroid for maybe some autoimmune disease or for some inflammatory disorder or something along those lines. But if you're looking in terms of endogenous causes of Cushing's syndrome, I said the most common cause, about like 70% of cases, if I'm not mistaken, is Cushing's disease, right? And then another fairly common cause is ectopic ACTH production, right? From like a small cell lung cancer, for example, right? So other things, right? I mean, like if a person has like adrenal hyperplasia or like an adrenal adenoma that's secreting cortisol, right? Those can also all cause hypercortisolism and Cushing's syndrome. So typically, the thing you do to diagnose Cushing's syndrome, right, is, you know, you can do one of two things, right? So you can remember for every condition in medicine, right, there's almost always some kind of screening test. And then after the screening test, there are other tests you do beyond that as kind of like a confirmatory test, right? So the thing you do is you can do one of two things for Cushing's syndrome. The first thing is you can decide to measure the 24-hour urinary free cortisol, right? If a person has Cushing's syndrome, it's going to be elevated, right? So you're like, you can do that. But actually, another screening test you can do is you can actually just go ahead and do the low-dose dexamethasone suppression test, right? You give low-dose dexamethasone. You typically expect that the person's morning cortisol, remember I said that cortisol is highest in the mornings, you'd expect that their morning cortisol should be suppressed, right? So the thing is, if you have like an elevated 24-hour urinary free cortisol or a person's morning cortisol is not suppressed with low-dose dexamethasone augmentation the night before, right? Then that tells you that the person has Cushing's syndrome. So that's your first step. But your second step is to ask yourself, is this an ACTH dependent cause of Cushing's syndrome or an ACTH independent cause of Cushing's syndrome? And the way you figure that out is literally just measure the person's ACTH levels, right? So you've done those first tests that I talked about, the 24-hour urinary free cortisol and the low-dose dexamethasone suppression test. You're like, okay, these people for sure have Cushing's syndrome. Well, the next thing you do is you then measure the ACTH levels. If the ACTH is low, then that tells you that the person has an ACTH independent cause of Cushing's syndrome. So the problem is likely in the adrenal glands. But if the ACTH is high, then that tells you that the person has an ACTH dependent cause of Cushing's syndrome. That's what you do in your second step, right? So in your second step, because if you figure out that the ACTH is low, then you know the problem is that the adrenal glands, your investigation is done pretty much at that point. But if you notice that the ACTH is high, you then need to go to a third step. Because classically on MBM exams, there are two causes of ACTH-dependent Cushing's syndrome. It can be Cushing's disease, where you have a pituitary adenoma that's making a crap ton of ACTH, or you can have an ectopic ACTH, you can have ectopic ACTH production from like a tumor or something like that, right? So classically, what you then do in that third step is the high-dose dexamethasone suppression test. When you do the high-dose dexamethasone suppression test, if you notice that the morning cortisol suppresses, then you know that's Cushing's disease. Then you do an MRI of the brain to find the pituitary adenoma. But if you notice that the high-dose dexamethasone does not suppress the ACTH production, I mean the cortisol, by like the morning cortisol, then you know that it's ectopic ACTH production, and then you start looking for like the small, it will almost always be a small cell lung cancer on the USMLE exams. So that's how you tease those things apart. Now, some last quick things I guess I want to go ahead and mention here is, if you really think about it, right, like if a person has Cushing syndrome, right, let's say they have a tumor or whatever that's causing it, obviously you want to try to resect that tumor. But one thing you may see on an, especially on the USMLE step one, is you may have to give those people ketoconazole. Ketoconazole is an antifungal, but it actually inhibits like multiple enzymes involved in the synthesis of glucocorticoids, right? So that can help with that. Actually, if you want to be a little more specific, ketoconazole actually inhibits cholesterol desmolase, right? Desmolase is one of the key gateway enzymes to the synthesis of a lot of things that we find in the adrenal glands. Now, the thing is, if a person has there are just some weird things that you may not necessarily think about, but I think I want to maybe go ahead and treat here. The thing is, when a person has an ACTH dependent cause of their Cushing syndrome, you should actually, what should you expect if you look at those people's adrenal glands on imaging? Well, I would hope you say that they should have like bilateral hyperplasia of the adrenal glands, okay? That's actually something that's very high yield to know and understand for exams, right? And that should make sense, because if you are systemically releasing ACTH, then that will stimulate both adrenal glands, right? Those people's adrenal glands will both undergo hyperplasia, right? So the thing is, compare and contrast this with a person that has like an ACTH independent cause of Cushing syndrome. So let's say, for example, a person has like an adenoma in the adrenal cortex that's secreting a ton of cortisol, right? That will suppress those people's ACTH, right? And if a person's ACTH is suppressed, then guess what? Those people will actually have like atrophy of the adrenal glands, right? Or let's assume you're exogenously taking steroids for like an autoimmune disease. That will also, again, suppress your ACTH, and that will cause bilateral atrophy of the adrenal glands. So again, I would really hope that you understand that stuff. This stuff, again, you may say Devon, you're being a little too particular, blah, 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 blah. But these things are all important to know for exams. And personally, I think that is all I want to say about, about Cushing syndrome. So I think one thing that, you know, probably makes sense for me to go ahead and discuss, although this shouldn't take me much time, is, let's see, what other topic do I have in mind to talk about? I guess we can talk about like Kahn syndrome, right? So let's go ahead and talk about Kahn syndrome, right? So the thing is, Kahn syndrome, right? I mean, sometimes you may see it on NBME exams, referred to as like primary hyperaldosteronism. This is just, again, a tumor. Usually it's like it can be like an adenoma in the adrenal cortex that's making a crap ton of aldosterone, right? And the thing is, if you have high levels of aldosterone, right? Again, remember this principal cell business we talked about yesterday. It will increase sodium reabsorption, right? So water will follow. So you become volume expanded. So you have hypertension, right? We also talked about how you would waste potassium also at the principal cell, right? So you get a hypokalemia. And then we also talked about how when you have high levels of aldosterone, that will activate the proton pump that we find on the urinary surface of the alpha intercalated cells, right? So that will cause a metabolic alkalosis, because you're literally like dumping protons in the urine, right? So the thing is, primary hyperaldosteronism, again, when you see the word primary, that means the problem is at the level of the adrenals, right? So that means, so let's kind of examine, right? So what are some things that can cause primary hyperaldosteronism? Because again, I just kind of said at the beginning, oh, you could have an adrenal adenoma in the cortex that's making a ton of aldosterone. Well, that's not always the case, right? The thing is, you can actually have like just bilateral hyperplasia of the adrenal glands. And because you have bilateral hyperplasia, you have like hyperplasia of the zona glomerulosa in both adrenals, and then you're making a crap ton of aldosterone with that. In fact, the most common cause, this is very high yield to know, the most common cause of primary hyperaldosteronism is bilateral adrenal hyperplasia, okay? But if you have an adenoma, right, like in one adrenal gland that's making a ton of aldosterone, that can also cause a primary hyperaldosteronism. But in that specific case, that's what's known as Kahn syndrome, okay? Kahn syndrome is primary hyperaldosteronism that arises from an adrenal adenoma that's making aldosterone, okay? But primary hyperaldosteronism, again, like I said, can also be caused by bilateral adrenal hyperplasia. Now that I've talked about primary hyperaldosteronism, Well, what can cause secondary hyperaldosteronism, right? Because again, hyperaldosteronism can arise from many different causes that are outside of the adrenal glands, right? The classic one you'll see is if a person has any kind of low flow state with regards to the renal arteries, right? Like the afferent arterial, if you want to be a little more specific. Because think about it, right? Like if you're not, let's say for example, a person has like renal artery stenosis, right? Or fibromuscular dysplasia. Those people are not going to be perfusing the afferent arterioles properly. So the GG cells will freak out, start making a ton of renin. That renin will convert angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1. And then angiotensin 1 will travel to the lungs. And then the endothelial cells in the pulmonary capillaries will convert the angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. And then that angiotensin 2 will go to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal gland, more specifically the adrenal cortex, and go ahead and make you make more aldosterone, right? So that can cause secondary hyperaldosteronism. But there are other things, right? Because again, your friends at the MBME, they know that pretty much everyone has memorized this renal artery stenosis business. So, you know, there are some more things that, again, make sense if you just know them or think about them or they are brought to your attention, right? So, for example, if a person has CHF, well, if you have CHF, yes, there's nothing wrong with your renal arteries, but you're going to be hypoperfusing them because you don't have enough cardiac outputs to send blood forward. Right? Or if a person has cirrhosis, if your liver is the primary source of protein in the body, so if you're not able to make protein, then guess what happens? You will not be able to maintain adequate oncotic pressures in your bloodstream. And if you're not able to maintain oncotic pressures, then you will hypoperfuse because you have a lot of fluid extravasation. So your intravascular volume will be down. And if that happens, then you will not have enough fluid in your vascular tree to perfuse the afferent arterial. Or if a person has like nephrotic syndrome, you're literally like peeing out protein. Right? So again, that kills your oncotic pressures, that kills your intravascular volumes, you hypoperfuse the afferent arterial, and you kick off the renin angiotensin aldosterone system. Or if, for example, a person has Ménétrier's disease, that's where you're essentially like getting rid of protein, but through your GI tract, right? That can again also kill your oncotic pressures, and that can cause a secondary hyperaldosteronism, right? So again, all these things, again, the classic presentation will be a person that will have like resistant hypertension, they'll have a metabolic alkalosis, which I've talked about the mechanism behind that, and they also have hypokalemia, right? And remember, hypokalemia, right, can cause problems on an EKG, right? It can cause a prolongation of the QT interval, you can see like a flat T wave, you can see like the U waves and stuff like that. But also remember, because these people have a metabolic alkalosis, remember, albumin is the primary protein in the body, and albumin has a lot of carboxylic acid groups, right? So if you remember from organic chemistry in college, like, you know, you have like a carbonyl group, like you have your carbon double bond to oxygen, and then you have carbon single bond to an oxygen, and then that oxygen is paired up with a hydrogen, right? That hydrogen is very acidic, right? So because a carboxyl group, right, it has like a pH of around like 5, right? So the thing is that carboxyl group, in the presence of a metabolic alkalosis, you will strip off that hydrogen ion from the carboxyl group. You will expose a negative charge so you're essentially forming like a carboxylate anion. So that negative charge on that oxygen that is free is very reactive. And the thing is, it actually reacts very nicely with calcium. Okay, so it will bind up that calcium. And when it binds up that calcium, that can actually cause a hypocalcemia, right? So the free calcium in a person that has a metabolic alkalosis will actually be decreased, but the total serum calcium, right, will be normal, okay? But the free calcium, the ionized calcium, the calcium that is metabolically active, will be decreased because it's paired off basically with those free oxygen anions that we find from those carboxyl groups that have been deprotonated by the metabolic alkalosis, right? So the thing is, you may say, oh, Divine, if a person has hyperaldosteronism, right, they keep reabsorbing sodium in the principal cell, water keeps following, why do those people not keep like reabsorbing fluid, and then they explode? Well, the good thing about your body is that your body has mechanisms in place to counteract hyperaldosteronism. And those things are known as the aldosterone escape mechanisms. The thing is, there are many mechanisms of aldosterone escape, but probably the only one I'll say that's probably like very useful for you to know, actually not a matter of very useful, very high yield for you to know for the USMLE exams is this, right? So think about it. If you're reabsorbing a ton of sodium, reabsorbing a ton of fluid at the same time, that will expand your intravascular volume, right? If your intravascular volume is expanded, right, then that would dilate your heart chambers, right? And if you dilate like your ventricles, for example, you release something known as atrial natriuretic peptide. The thing is, atrial natriuretic peptide basically makes you dump fluid. It essentially shuts down the fluid reabsorption, at the level of the nephron, right? So you dump a ton of fluid in your urine. So that helps you obviate some of the problems that happens when you have hyperaldosteronism. So again, think about intranatriuretic peptide as something like it kind of like inhibits like sodium reabsorption. So because you are inhibiting sodium reabsorption, then sodium stays in the like the lumen of the nephron and water follows, and then you have a natriuresis. That's why it's called atrial natriuretic peptide, right? Natriuretic. Remember, sodium is Na, right? I think the Greek name or the Latin name for sodium is natrium, right? So natriuretic peptide, right? It gets rid of sodium, water follows, right? So that's one of the aldosterone escape mechanisms. It's a mechanism to escape from hyperaldosteronism, right? And the thing is, this is why typically, right, if a person has like Kahn syndrome, right, you may say, oh, this person has hypertension, so it's bad. So let me put them on the classic hypertensive, like antihypertensives, like a diuretic, for example. That's a terrible idea. If you put a person, let's say, or like a person that has hyperaldosteronism on like a loop diuretic, right, they can have a profound hypokalemia, like profound hypokalemia that can throw them into arrhythmias, right? So if a person has resistant hypertension and they have it from Kahn syndrome, it makes more sense to go ahead and give those people like, you want to give them something more along the lines of like spironolactone or eplerenone, because that would directly like target the pathophysiology of their problem. Remember, spironolactone is an aldosterone receptor antagonist, but it also has androgen receptor blocking activity, so it can cause gynecomastia. And actually, spironolactone also inhibits 5-alpha reductase in the skin, so it can actually be used to treat hirsutism, believe it or not, right? But eplerenone is special in the sense that all it does is it blocks aldosterone receptors. It also does not concurrently block androgen receptors, so you classically will not observe gynecomastia in a person that is taking eplerenone, but obviously eplerenone should be more expensive by virtue of that. So again, you really want to be careful. You really do not want to give like a loop diuretic or a thiazide diuretic or anything of that sort to a person that has resistant hypertension from like hyperaldosteronism, right? That would not be a great idea. And remember, right, the levels of renin, right, in a person that has secondary hyperaldosteronism, their renin levels will be high, right? But in a person that has primary hyperaldosteronism, their renin levels will be low. That should make sense, right? Because if you have like an adrenal adenoma, again, making a ton of aldosterone, right, your intravascular volume expands, you will hyperperfuse your afferent arterial, so that will shut down the GG cell so you don't make renin, right? Versus a person that has like renal artery stenosis, for example, giving rise to secondary hyperaldosteronism, they are not perfusing the afferent arterioles, right? So it's the GG cells that kick off the hyperaldosteronism pretty much, so their renin levels are high. So again, it's a subtle difference, but it's one of those things people don't think much about that ends up being very high yield for purposes of the USMLE exams. So I guess to kind of wrap up today, let me just basically talk about like some malignancies that arise in like around like the adrenal gland. So let's talk about some like, you know, like pheochromocytoma and all that stuff, neuroblastoma. Yeah, let's kind of mention those real quick and then we'll kind of move on and then we'll be done with this adrenal podcast. So basically, right, like I guess some key things you want to keep in mind, you can have like adenomas that adenomas that grow in the adrenal cortex. The thing is, actually, most adenomas of the adrenal cortex, they are benign. They typically don't have, like, they typically don't hypersecrete anything. But occasionally, they may hypersecrete stuff, right? Like, you can have an adrenal adenoma that's making a ton of cortisol, which can give rise to, like, an ACTH-independent cause of Cushing syndrome. Or you can have an adrenal adenoma that's making a ton of aldosterone, right? And then that will give rise to, like, primary hyperaldosteronism, aka Kahn syndrome, right? So that's kind of like the big thing. And I mean, usually when you see these adrenal adenomas, you just go ahead and take out the entire adrenal gland on that side, okay? You go ahead and take out the adrenal gland on that side. But the thing is, in the adrenal gland, people can also have like adrenal carcinomas, right? But let me go ahead and mention this. Remember, I said adrenal adenomas, right? They are benign. And I said that most of them are non-functional, right? But because most of them are non-functional, right? Like, let me put it this way. I think maybe a compare and contrast is a more appropriate way to discuss this concept. There's adrenal adenomas, those are benign. There's adrenal carcinomas, those are not benign. Adrenal adenomas, by definition, I'll say for the most part, right, tend to be non-functional. But some of them can overproduce some adrenal gland hormone. On the flip side, adrenal carcinomas almost always tend to hypersecrete something, right? In fact, that is usually what brings those disorders to clinical attention, right? So adrenal carcinomas in general, most of them are not non-functional. Most of them actually secrete a ton of stuff, okay? Most of them actually secrete a ton of stuff, right? So most of them can actually like hypersecrete like cortisol. Most of them can hypersecrete aldosterone. Some of them can hypersecrete like sex steroids, like androgens, right? So those are all things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And the thing is, one thing your friends at the NBME love to do, right? Because, I mean, I've kind of talked about this in a prior podcast about like, oh, how you can use like that. Like sometimes you'll see an NBME question where they draw like a bimodal graph to illustrate certain concepts like the differences between like slow and fast acetylators, or the differences between, I think Hodgkin's disease that, you know, shows up like very early in life, or it can show up like later in life, like there's this spike later in life. That bimodal distribution principle also kind of applies to people that have like carcinomas of the adrenal cortex, right? So the thing is, it can happen typically like, you know, there's this big spike before the age of 5, but there's also this big spike when people hit like their 50s, their late 40s and things of that nature, right? So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And also remember, again, a lot of tumors love to metastasize to the adrenal glands, right? So like lung cancer, liver cancer, right? Those things all love to metastasize to the adrenal glands. So that's all I think I'm going to say about like tumors that exist in the adrenal cortex. And I guess one thing I should mention is if a person has Kahn syndrome, right? Like the screening test you'll do is you'll measure their plasma aldosterone levels, right? And you'll also measure their plasma renin levels, right? So a person that has Kahn syndrome, aka like primary hyperaldosteronism, they'll have an increased PAC to PRA ratio, right? So their plasma aldosterone to renin concentration will be increased, right? And then if you're like, oh, this person's plasma aldosterone to renin concentration is increased, so let me then confirm my diagnosis of primary hyperaldosteronism. The way you confirm that diagnosis is you do something known as a salt suppression test, okay? You do something known as a salt suppression test. For the normal individual, if you give them salt, right, by the administration of salt, you actually tend to shut down the production of aldosterone, right? So failure of a person's aldosterone to suppress with salt augmentation is diagnostic of primary hyperaldosteronism, okay? And then after that, you do some kind of imaging to figure out what's going on, right? The thing is, as a general principle in endocrinology, if a person has an excess of something, the confirmatory test usually involves some suppression test of some sort, right? But if a person has a deficiency of something, the confirmatory test almost always involves some kind of stimulation of that thing, right? That's just a very nice, handy-dandy general principle to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? So primary hyperaldosteronism, again, they have like an elevated PAC to PRA ratio. That is not the case with a person that has secondary hyperaldosteronism because their renin and their aldosterone increases like in lockstep. So typically those people may have like a decreased or a normal plasma aldosterone to renin ratio. So that's one of those just weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, what if they give you a question about like a child, like a newborn, or, you know, like a 6-month-old kid, and they tell you that, oh, this child, his mom feels like a mass in his abdomen when they are trying to, like, you know, give him like a shower or something, right? They'll kind of set up the question that way. But they may say that, oh, this child has like weird vertical and horizontal movements of the eyes, right? And then they also tell you that this child has like weird movements of the upper and lower extremities. If you see that, what tumor should you think about? The thing is, on the NBMEs, they'll be counting on you to pick Wilms tumor as an answer. Resist that temptation, okay? The thing is, Wilms tumor, for the most part, it will present with that flank mass, right? And then the kid may have like hypertension, right? And then the kid may have hematuria. That's all you will see. Wilms tumors do not cause like the weird movements of the eyes or the weird movements of the upper and lower extremities. If you see those things, you want to think more along the lines of a neuroblastoma, okay? So almost always, NBME questions that test neuroblastomas, they almost always put Wilms tumor as an answer choice there. So you want to be careful. So let me teach you some key things that can help you differentiate between a neuroblastoma and a Wilms tumor, and then I'll actually talk about a neuroblastoma. The thing is, a Wilms tumor tends to be on one side. It does not cross the midline, right? Wilms tumor does not cross the midline. Okay, Wilms tumor does not cross the midline and it tends to not be calcified. Okay, contrast this with a neuroblastoma that tends to cross the midline and tends to be calcified. Okay, so neuroblastomas cross the midline and they are calcified. That is classically the presentation on NBME exams, right? So the thing is, what's a neuroblastoma, right? A neuroblastoma is a tumor of the adrenal medulla. It's not an adrenal cortical problem. It's an adrenal medullary problem, right? And it almost always occurs in kids on NBME exams, right? And the thing is, you may not just find it only in the adrenal medulla. You can, because it's a neurogenic tumor, you can find it anywhere neural tumors grow, right? So you can find it like along the, you can find it along the like the sympathetic chain, right, close to the spinal cord, or you can find it in the mediastinum, believe it or not, right? But again, remember, would you find it in the anterior mediastinum or in the posterior mediastinum? I would really hope you're telling me that it's found in the anterior, in the posterior mediastinum. Remember, neurogenic tumors grow in the posterior mediastinum, right? In the anterior mediastinum, you may find tumors like teratomas, thymomas, lymphomas, things of that nature, okay? Now, that thing that I described about like the weird movements of the eyes, right? Those things, that's what's called opsoclonus, right? It's almost like the person having like a vertical and a horizontal nystagmus, right? And then those weird movements of the upper and lower extremities that I was describing, that's what's known as myoclonus, right? In fact, the pathognomonic feature on NBME exams of a neuroblastoma is something known as opsoclonus myoclonus syndrome, okay? That's, I mean, like, as far as I know, I've not really seen, at least from my studying, I've not really seen any good explanation of the pathophysiology behind that, right? So just be able to recognize that as a classic finding on NBMEs in neuroblastoma. And the thing is, neuroblastomas, they're not just tested on step one, they're also tested on step two CK and on the pediatric shelf. So that's something, it's something you definitely want to make sure you understand. Now, what are some labs that classically present, you know, that you may see in a person that has neuroblastoma? The thing is, neuroblastomas can actually cause increased amounts of like metanephrines in a person's urine and serum, right? So don't just think of that as being only under the purview of pheochromocytomas. You may actually see elevated levels of like VMA, HVA, and all that stuff, and metanephrines in a person's urine if they have a neuroblastoma. And then if we're looking at things from the cell biology perspective, right? People that actually have neuroblastomas, they actually tend to have like increased activity of the NMIC oncogene, right? It's like an actual oncogene. It actually promotes malignancy, right? So if you see like, you know, like amplification of the NMIC oncogene, you want to think about neuroblastoma with that. And one other marker you may see on NBMEs for neuroblastoma is something known as bombazin. Bombazin is just something that in the body ordinarily just increases the release of gastrin from G cells, right? It's like a gastrin releasing peptide kind of deal. But the thing is, if they like, they usually don't put gastrin releasing peptide, they usually put bombazin because it just, you know, it just sounds very odd, very weird, very awkward. So the NBME is counting on that to kind of mess with your mind on exams, right? So bombazin is a tumor marker for neuroblastomas. And the thing is, neuroblastomas, right? Like when you, these people, because you may actually see these kids present with like fevers and stuff, right? Typically, neuroblastomas, you may see it actually present with like elevated erythrocyte sedimentation rates on NBMEs, right? And then another marker you may also see that's increased in the serum is this thing known as a neuron-specific enolase, right? So again, let me backtrack and summarize here. A person that has a neuroblastoma, they will have an elevated ESR. Bombazin is like a tumor marker, right? They can also have elevated levels of NSE, right? Like neuron-specific enolase, right? And it's associated with an amplification in the NMIC oncogene, right? And on histology, you may also see like those homerite pseudo rosettes that we classically find in medulloblastomas. Remember, medulloblastomas have a homerite pseudo rosettes, but you can also find those in a neuroblastoma. Again, remember, a medulloblastoma is a neuro-based tumor. A neuroblastoma is also a neuro-based tumor, okay? So that's, again, just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then, if you want to diagnose a neuroblastoma, right, like you can do like abdominal imaging, you can do like an MIBG scan. It's like a nuclear medicine study that we occasionally do in radiology, and that helps you kind of see what's going on. Although on X-ray, again, they may tell you that, oh, on X-ray, you see a mass that's crossing the midline and it's calcified. If you see that, again, you want to think about a neuroblastoma under those circumstances. And actually most neuroblastomas, they just like spontaneously like resolve over time. But if they don't resolve, again, you can, you know, you can do like surgical resection or you can do like chemotherapy and all that stuff. But that's not what they're going to go after on NBME exams. Now, the last thing I think I'm actually going to go ahead and talk about is a pheochromocytoma, right? A pheochromocytoma, again, is an adrenal medullary tumor, right? Although again, remember, you don't just only find it in the adrenal medulla. You can find it again in the posterior mediastinum. You can find it along the sympathetic chain, juxtaposed to the spinal cord. And remember that pheochromocytomas, right? Like they have these kind of like the way Meckel's diverticulum has like those 2% rules. It also has like those 10% rules, right? So like a person that has pheochromocytoma, like 10% of them, 10% of, like 90% of pheos are benign, but 10% of them can be malignant, right? 90% of pheos, you typically find them in the adrenal medulla, right? But 10% of them, you may find them outside the adrenal glands, right? 10% of them can be bilateral. 10% of them can calcify, right? And like 10% of them, like most people that have pheochromocytomas, the classic presentation is they'll have like, you know, like episodic headache and hypertension, right? But there are 10% of people that, like if you take all the people that present with it, that are ultimately diagnosed with pheos, 10% of them will not present with hypertension, right? So they may just present with like headache, right? Like they may present with like, you know, like pressure style symptoms that they may have like headache, they may have like palpitations from like tachycardia, because again, they are secreting a crap ton of catecholamines. They may have like pallor, right? They may, because remember that vasoconstriction will cut off blood supply to like key regions of the body, right? Or they may have like these episodes where they just have like headache and sweating, right? So those are the big things you want to keep at the back of your mind with pheos. And the thing is, it's actually very high yield to remember that there are certain genetic conditions that have an association with pheochromocytoma, right? Like MEN2A and 2B, right? Those have associations with pheos. NF1, neurofibromatosis type 1, right? Also has an association with pheochromocytomas. And also VHL, right? Von Hippel-Lindau. Remember, VHL has a lot of high yield associations that you want to know for the USMLEs, right? Like it has an association with like hemangioblastomas, has an association with like pancreatic cysts, has an association with like bilateral renal cell carcinomas and things of that nature, right? So VHL, remember it's a chromosome 3 problem, autosomal dominant inheritance, also has an association with a pheochromocytoma. And one thing you may also want to keep in mind with pheochromocytomas is that if you want to, you know, take these people for surgery or whatever, or you just want to treat them, right? You want to remember that you give alpha blockers first before you give beta blockers, right? You give an alpha blocker first, because if you give a beta blocker, right, you can have unopposed alpha stimulation, and then those people can have a hypertensive crisis and die, right? That's not an ideal outcome, right? So you want to, you know, give an alpha blocker first, like phenoxybenzamine or phentolamine, and then after that you give a beta blocker, right? And then you can then take them to surgery, right? You don't want to like be messing with a tumor and then say, oh, you know, we'll be careful with the tumor during surgery. No. If you have that massive systemic release of catecholamines during the course of the surgery, the patient will very likely die on the operating table, right? So again, usually this is done like 2 weeks ahead of time. You do like very good pre-op planning. You block alpha receptors first. So go with your A before your B, and then you block beta receptors. So I think that's all I'm going to say about pheos. But again, pheos, if you see an adrenal medullary tumor in an adult, not in a kid, in an adult, think about a pheo. If you see an adrenal medullary tumor in a kid, think about neuroblastoma. Okay, think about neuroblastoma. So I think that's all I'm going to say from the adrenal perspective. And really, I feel like I don't think there's any major thing that I'm missing from my mind. I feel like if you listen to episodes 191 and 192, you become an adrenal master, right? So in the next podcast, again, I'll talk about more endocrine concepts, and then we'll go from there. So as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step 1, step 2 CK, step 3, step 2 CS. If you're a medicine resident, I offer tutoring for like the medicine in training exam, the ABIM board exam. I also tutor for like preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. And then if you have like a college buddy that needs tutoring for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, I tutor for all those things. And then I also do like coaching for like if you're like a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or like a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application. I have a lot of experience working with people. Many people I've worked with have matched at their first choices. And I have admissions committee experience at a top 2 med school. So like, you know, coaching with like, you know, like mock interviews, personal statement writing, editing applications, things of that nature. Again, I've worked with tons of people on those. And again, for all these different exams that I'm mentioning, right, be it small group tutoring, be it large group tutoring, again, just reach out to me either through the website or you send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. And then I also offer like this thing I call like a USMLE booster course. It's like 10 hours for step 2 CK or step 3 or 20 hours for step 1, where if you're at the end of your dedicated period, or you know, you kind of want someone to put everything together for you really quickly in a Q&A format, where you essentially review like many of the must knows for the exam, feel free to reach out to me. There's kind of special pricing on that, but we can always talk about that over email. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.